flee his cause in this land in these times. I think that, you talk about an oxymoron. Well, I bless you for your labors, and whether or not we need to come out of America herself, or certainly out of the ways of the culture, friends, we've got to start, and we've got to take seriously God's message, come out of her, my people, and judgment is coming. No question about that. In fact, I believe we've already had a series of progressive judgments for the last 18 years on this country.
Right.
And I believe that the Gulf spill is one gigantic judgment on this America, on America. As one writer said, literally the lifeblood of America is surging out from the seabed in the form of red oil. Well, get a copy of the book, The End of America, The Role of Islam in the End Times and Biblical Warnings to Flee America. Your gift of $15 or more to Save America Ministries will put the fascinating book in your hands. Call us, 1-800-SAVE-USA. Become a partner with us. Send your gifts by faith to Save America Ministries, P.O. Box 70879, Richmond, Virginia, 23255. Friends, don't wait for the other guy to do it. He's not doing. Today is the day of salvation. Let's get serious about this. Go before God and ask what he would have you to give, and help us to get this message out while there's still time. God bless. Be a blessing. And pray for the peace of America.
You've been listening to the
Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that'll determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views. And, well, for the next hours, they're going to be the views of John Carrico. We're going to be talking about his book, Reluctant Spy. And, you know, we see a lot of things happening all the time. America got involved in a war in Iraq, and, of course, we entered that war in 2003. And the reason we attacked is because the president told us that, we found that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, and they threatened our country, and Colin Powell went before the United Nations and talked all about those weapons of mass destruction. They were such a threat to the United States, and that's why we were going to have to invade Iraq in 2003. But how do we know what truth is? I mean, how do you really get the truth? Because basically you have people who work for government, and if they ever tell the truth, they face imprisonment or even worse. And most people are not willing to risk their jobs or their families or their lives ready to come forward and tell the truth about what they learned when they were working in government. And when you work in government, you sign an agreement saying that you will not reveal anything you found out unless, of course, you have special permission to do it. Well, John really worked for the CIA for a good period of time. He has a fascinating story, and parts of the story you've never heard about before, but he has one of the most amazing revelations you're ever going to hear, and you're not going to read about this in Newsweek magazine or U.S. News and World Report or elsewhere. That's why we're so pleased to have John with us this evening. John Carrico, author of Reluctant Spy. Hi, John. How you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan. Thank you so much for having me.
Well, it's really a pleasure to have you. Of course, we've got a real good listening audience this time of evening, you know, both sides of the country. So why don't you tell our listeners just a little bit about yourself, how it was that you ended up working as a CIA and for the CIA, and wound up, of course, leading the effort to capture one of the most important Taliban leaders of the terrorist movement ever captured. And well, just give the background, and then we'll get into some of your amazing revelations in your book.
Thank you. I was in graduate school at George Washington University in the late 1980s, and I was taking a class called The Psychology of Leadership, and it was being taught by a psychiatrist. He actually called himself a political psychiatrist. in that he had a PhD in psychology, a medical degree, and a PhD in political science. And the class was just fascinating. It looked at the at world leaders and their state of mind at critical times in history. So I got a lot out of it. And he assigned us a paper one night where we had to shadow our bosses and then write a psychological evaluation of our bosses. So I did that, and he liked my paper and asked me to stay after class the following week. He asked me if I had any plans for graduation, and I said, well, I'm getting married right after graduation, and I don't have a job, and I don't seem to have any prospects for a job, and I'm not sure what I'm going to do. And he said, well, would you consider working for the CIA? And I thought about it, and I said, well, sure, I guess so. I hadn't really considered the CIA, but why not? Well, it turned out that this professor was actually undercover as a professor. He was acting as a CIA spotter back in the days when the CIA did this kind of thing. It's illegal now to do that because of equal opportunity employment laws. And he picked up the phone and called somebody in CIA personnel, and a week later I entered into a series of tests for the agency, mostly written tests followed by medical exams and then a polygraph in the end, and the next thing I knew, I was starting my first day at the CIA.
Hold that thought. We'll be back in just a moment with John Carrico. His book, Reluctant Spy. We'll be right back. All right, John, why don't you go ahead? So you get into the CIA, and then what happens?
Well, I get into the CIA, and I enter into the Directorate of Intelligence, which is the analytic cadre of the agency. And I'm assigned to Iraq and Kuwait, which at the time, I'm told, is a training account in that nothing ever happens in Iraq or Kuwait. It's the same cabinet in Iraq since the 1968 revolution, the same leadership in Kuwait since the country declared independence in the early 1960s. So they said, learn the CIA writing style, become an expert on these countries, and then you can transfer onto something more interesting like Romania. So just at the point, about 9 months later, where I felt like I knew what I was doing, Iraq invades Kuwait. And one of the senior analysts came to me and said, look, it's not unusual for a country we cover to invade another country we cover. What is unusual is for a country we cover to go to war with us. You need to make some hay out of this. This is a big deal. It's a big opportunity. Work hard and good things are going to happen. So I worked hard and soon found myself briefing the president, the vice president, the secretary of state, and I really became the go-to guy on Iraq through the Gulf War.
All right, fine. Well, that was exciting. This was the first Gulf War in 1991, and so then what happened after the war ended? So we pulled our troops back. We did not try to get Saddam. We did not try to really, of course, take Iraq itself. We just simply drove Saudi Arabia drove Iraq out of Kuwait, and then we, of course, set up a no-fly zone, and we started bombing Iraq on a regular basis. So
indeed,
for the next 10 years,
indeed, on a regular basis, we bombed them over the next decade, and we had in the end just about nothing to show for it. I remember at the time, and I know I realize that hindsight is 20/20, but I remember at the time my colleagues and I standing around the television, watching the first President Bush explain why he decided to call a unilateral ceasefire. And I remember people just being beside themselves because the job wasn't done. True, we had liberated Kuwait, but what about Iraq? You know, the Iraqi people expected our assistance, at least the Shia Muslims in the south, and we turned our backs on those people. And afterwards, there was a wholesale slaughter of Shia Muslims in the south, only because we encouraged them but never did anything to protect them. So I decided to continue on Iraq until Saddam Hussein was overthrown. But by 1993, it was pretty clear Saddam Hussein wasn't going anywhere. And so I applied for a one-year or two-year, rather, rotational assignment in the State Department that allowed me to...
Hold up, Tom. We'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Of course, John was there then. He was initially assigned to Iraq and Kuwait, and that was there when... Iraq invaded Kuwait, and of course, really President Bush encouraged the Shias, Shia Muslims in Iraq to rise up against Saddam Hussein. He even said, you know, we'll help you, you rise up. And everybody thought America was going to take down Saddam Hussein, the wicked Saddam Hussein. And the Shias did exactly as they were encouraged to do. And then we let Saddam Hussein use his helicopters. We could have stopped him at any time because we controlled the air, but we let him use his helicopters, and they slaughtered, you know, tens of hundreds of thousands or hundreds of thousands of the Shia Muslims who believed George W. Bush, H.W. Bush, and then we began, you know, bombing Iraq. We bombed Iraq for 10 years. Nothing was accomplished. And, of course, John is witnessing this. And so at what point was it you asked to be rotated back into the State Department?
I asked to go to the State Department in 1993. And so the CIA sent me first to Arabic language training. That took a full year, but I came out with some conversational fluency. And then I went to Bahrain for 2 years. That was 1994 to 1996. And then I thought, okay, I'll get this out of my system, this foreign travel bug that I seem to have, and I'll go back and do something interesting. Well, by 1996, the only game in town was, unfortunately, Iraq again. So I went back onto Iraq in 1996 and continued to do that for another couple of years.
All right. Because Iraq at that time was under Saddam's control. Were you up in the northern part, right, in the Kurdistan area?
That's correct. We had good relations with the Kurds at the time. They had a certain amount of autonomy because of that no-fly zone up north. But we were in this stalemate where we could have continued doing this forever. Saddam would violate the no-fly zone. We would bomb an empty building in the middle of the night, and we would continue this pattern indefinitely.
All right, fine. Were you there when Robert Baer was there? Was he up there with you?
I sure was. Bob Baer is a good friend of mine. Okay. He was very helpful in this book.
Yeah, well, that's great, because we've interviewed him and certainly we carry his book. We think, you know, we really enjoy his story, See No Evil. Under any circumstances. So you're there, and you're working in Kurdistan, and you're actually recruiting people for the CIA. Was that your job, was to get people who are willing to work for the CIA covertly?
Right. The job of a CIA officer, very simply, is to recruit spies to steal secrets. And in many places, like Iraq or Afghanistan even, you can't do that directly because maybe you don't have the language. More likely, the locals are not willing to speak with an American. And so you have to recruit people who can act on the U.S. government's behalf and recruit spies for you so that you can infiltrate some of these terrorist groups. That's what CIA officers were doing in Iraq, and then later that's what we did in Afghanistan and Pakistan as well.
All right, fine. So you did that, and then, of course, how did you get back up into Pakistan? Because that's where, you, of course, you had one of your greatest triumphs, and that, of course, was the capture of this key Taliban leader. When was that?
That was in March of 2002. After September 11th, like everybody else in the building, I volunteered to go to Afghanistan and fight. And I mean, I really wanted to go and fight. But because I didn't have any paramilitary experience, I was passed over. And I would complain to everybody who would listen that I want to go. You have to let me go. And I wasn't the only one doing this. Everybody was doing this kind of thing because we all really wanted to go. Finally, I think they had enough of my complaints. And they said, fine. Can you go to Pakistan? I said, definitely. When? Tomorrow morning. I said, done. So the next day, I got on a plane, and I went to Pakistan, and I became chief of counterterrorism operations there for the CIA.
Well, now that's a pretty responsible job for somebody who just sort of shows up there, you know, unannounced.
It's true. I hounded them until they finally relented. One of the funny things, too, is that I really had very little operational experience. I had done one overseas operational tour, but I was not really a seasoned counterterrorism officer. So on my first day on the job, I went in to introduce myself to the deputy station chief, and he kind of looked up, and I think he assumed that I was a seasoned operations officer. In fact, I was a seasoned analyst. And he said, listen, I need for you to come up with a plan on how we take down a terrorist safe house. We need to have a standard operating procedure. So I went back to my office, and I literally sat there with a legal pad, and I was thinking to myself, well, if I were going to take down a terrorist safe house, how would I start? And I finally came up with something that I thought made some sense and proposed it, and that became our standard for doing counterterrorism raids in Pakistan.
But, of course, the thing is that the Taliban, certainly Taliban leaders were there, certainly at that time, why we don't know where Osama bin Laden was. They supposedly was hiding somewhere in Pakistan, but they were concerned about other Taliban leaders, and who was the one Taliban leader that they were so important and interested in targeting?
We were most interested in Abu Zubaydah, who was actually an al-Qaeda leader.
All right.
For a couple of reasons. Number one, he was the commander of the larger of al-Qaeda's training camps in Afghanistan. And we believed he was the number three person in al-Qaeda at the time. More than that, and this is really the reason why he was so valuable, was that he was what al-Qaeda officials described as the hub of the wheel. He knew everybody in the organization. He was great at logistics. He was a detail man. And we thought if we could capture him, then we would be able to disrupt countless attacks. So we set out looking for him. But the only instructions that we had were that we had to take him alive, and he was somewhere in Pakistan. But Pakistan is the size of Texas, and it has 55 million people in it. So we were left to our own devices to figure out exactly how to do that.
All right, fine. And so basically, well, how many were there? 10 or 20 different houses he could be in, any one of them.
Right.
You had to raid them all simultaneously, hoping that you'd get the right one.
Yes, we had never done more than two counter-terrorist raids in a single night. And unfortunately, we just could not get the possible targets any lower than 14. And so we decided that we were going to just try our best, and we were going to hit all 14 sites simultaneously at 2 o'clock in the morning, and just hope for the best. So we brought in a large team from Washington, half CIA, half FBI, with plenty of weapons and equipment and night vision goggles and hallets of electronic devices and equipment, and we hit all 14 sites at exactly the same time. Sure enough, much to our surprise, there he was. He tried to escape, and he was involved in a shootout with Pakistani police. He was shot three times and very severely wounded.
Well, now, eventually, was he cooperative as far as revealing information to the CIA?
In the beginning, no. I had some long conversations with him. I was the first person to guard him and the first person to speak with him when he came out of his coma following surgery. And I told him, look, I'm the nicest guy you're going to encounter in this experience. So I urge you to cooperate. You're our prisoner now, and your life can be very difficult or it can be very easy. I'm going to tell you again and again, you have to cooperate. And in the beginning, he was not sure he was going to survive. He was not really interested in cooperating, and I would repeat the message as frequently as I could. He would rather have spoken about poetry and about Islam, how Islam was better than Christianity, and he would go through these emotional periods where he would cry and say how he would never know the touch of a woman, he would never know the joy of fatherhood, and I would repeat, look, you're an adult, you knew exactly what you were getting into, you knew those towers were going to come down, you have to face the consequences of your actions. But he would not give me any actionable information. There was nothing I could really work with.
Well, basically, did he tell you that he did not favor the attack on America? I know many of the al-Qaeda people really didn't want to do that, but they were concerned about the consequences of bringing it down. Did he play any part, really, in bringing down the Twin Towers?
No, not really. And in the beginning, we thought that he had, but he did not play any direct role. He did support the attack, but he said that really he had no problem with the Americans. His problem was with the Israelis, and he was very clear that his goal was to kill Jews, not Americans. But because this was something that bin Laden himself had ordered, he had gone along with it.
All right, fine. So basically, but I think the most one of the most significant things was when you actually you got raided these homes, you got all sorts of records on all sorts of telephone calls by the Al-Qaeda to Taliban centers and Al-Qaeda centers all across the United States, and the really, what, dozens of them or something, and our government refused to follow through on the information? That didn't make sense.
No, this was really something that was very chilling to me. We raided the Taliban embassy in Peshawar, Pakistan, and as part of the haul, and when I say haul, we took everything. We took all their computers, their filing cabinets, their cell phones, their weapons, you name it, we took it. And as part of this haul, we found a file folder full of telephone bills, and the telephone bills reflected 163 calls from the Taliban embassy in Peshawar, Pakistan, to numbers in the United States, all across the United States. Buffalo, Los Angeles, Chicago, Kansas City, Bethesda, Maryland, all over the place. 163 calls. They ended abruptly on September the 10th, 2001, and then they started up again on September the 16th. So we informed the FBI, saying, be aware, we think we stumbled onto something very important, and the FBI responded by saying, thank you very much, good catch, please send us the originals. So we sent the originals, and we heard nothing. At the end of my tour in Pakistan, I asked again, what's going on with those numbers? And I was told, numbers have been received, we're working on it, thanks for your interest.
But no real follow-through as far as you could tell. And we have to ask ourselves, if we're really involved in a war on terrorism, why weren't they tracking all of those telephone calls? We'll be right back with John here. Well, John, you go ahead, pick the story up.
Thank you. So we informed FBI headquarters of these calls, and they said that they would investigate. In fact, we learned later that they did not investigate. And the excuse I heard was ridiculous.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think it really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Berkey water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Berkey water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. Call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order it on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
Right up until September 10th, 2001, and then resuming again on the 16th of September. And, of course, these telephone calls, they knew the numbers the telephone calls went to from the Taliban headquarters, obviously Taliban sympathizers, and yet the FBI steadfastly refused to actually follow through with the information, and their excuse was, well, we can't speak Arabic, and of course, as John pointed out, but the information was in English. I mean, anybody could look at it, be very, very simple, but the FBI, for some reason, steadfastly refused to follow through with the evidence that would have allowed them to track down Taliban agents all across America back in the 2003, I guess it was, and to this date they've never done that. We have to ask ourselves why John thinks it's just incompetence. Well, I think probably the most significant thing, or one of the interesting things about your book, after you had left the CIA and you wrote your book, why you wanted to tell the story, and it has some very important information in it, and but you had to submit it to the CIA. And basically, you got the book back, every page blocked out. So why don't you pick up the story, how you were actually able to get the information? Because, ladies and gentlemen, there's information in this book you will never hear elsewhere. And everything was done to suppress it. Would you tell the story?
You know, again, at the risk of sounding dramatic, this really was the book that the CIA does not want you to read. As you said, Dr. Stan, I submitted my book, the first draft, for CIA clearance, and it came back 3 months later with every single word blacked out. And they said, the book is rejected in its entirety because the entire document is classified. They said, it's currently and properly classified. So there's an elaborate appeal process, and I went back and I appealed, and I said, look, it's not classified that I was raised in Western Pennsylvania, and it's not classified that I speak Greek. So they said, fine, the first chapter is cleared, everything else is redacted. And again, I appealed. I said, it's not classified that I went to George Washington University. It's not classified that I applied because a professor of mine spotted me and thought I should apply. Okay, the first two chapters are cleared, everything is redacted. I ended up going through 9 separate drafts over the course of 2 years. And finally, when I went to submit the 9th draft, somebody from the CIA's Publications Review Board called me and said, why don't you come in for a face-to-face meeting? Well, I knew from colleagues, including Bob Baer, that the purpose of a face-to-face meeting was just to convince me to walk away from the project and to not publish any book. So I went in, and we argued about 3 central chapters in the book that they were objecting to, and then they offered some alternative language. Well, I readily accepted this alternative language, and I made a big production by saying, well, this is great, we have an agreement, we have a book. I shook their hands. Finally, one of the board members said, let me walk you to your car. And I knew that this was going to be the real message that I had been summoned there to receive. Once we got outside the building, he said, look, even if you make these changes, we're still going to reject the book because you have a lot of enemies here, because I had spoken out against waterboarding in December of 2007 in an interview on ABC News. And He said, I thought you deserved an explanation. And I said, well, my attorney is really chomping at the bit to file a federal suit, but I appreciate your warning. And then I went to my car, and I called a former CIA colleague of mine. This was the week before the 2008 presidential election. And my colleague said that he was on the transition team for the Obama campaign for intelligence, that I should go ahead and make these changes to the book, but not resubmit it until he told me to. So I made the changes. A week later, Senator Obama is elected president, and I waited 6 weeks. And finally, my colleague called back and said, go ahead and resubmit. There's been some change in the CIA's leadership. So I submitted it, and a week later, they cleared the book in its entirety.
And that's why, I mean, it's just almost miraculous that this story gets out, because as we'll tell you in the next half hour, what is that they, John, discovered in the early part of the year 2002, certainly shortly after the September 11th attack. He'll tell you exactly what it was, but this was the early part of 2002. He was given information that every American should know, but they didn't want you to know. They still don't want you to know. I really think it was a fluke or God's intervention, but at least it's here in the book, The Reluctant Spy, and we'll tell you more about it when we get back right here at Radio Liberty. And this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. And Sydney, how did it happen? I mean, here you were at a good profession, working in the CIA. Why did you resign from the CIA?
Well, one of the problems with the CIA's culture is that the job is very, very hard on marriages. I was determined to not become a CIA divorce statistic. And unfortunately, that's exactly what happened to me. In 2002, my wife of 14 years and I divorced, and she moved back to Ohio with our two young sons. And I made the decision that it was more important for me to have a relationship with my boys than it was to continue working for the agency. So I'm very happy that I made the choice to choose my sons over my career. That was an easy decision. I've missed the agency every day that I've been gone, but the decision was the right one.
All right, and do you want to spend your weekends with your sons, or how does that work?
I do. What I ended up doing was driving to Ohio every Friday afternoon, picking up my sons and spending the weekend at my parents' house, which was nearby. I would do that until Sunday, and then I would return to Washington. I'm proud to say that in 10 years, I've never missed a weekend.
All right, fine. And now, actually, you're working in one of the legislative offices there?
Yes, I'm a senior staff member in the United States Senate, working for one of the Senate's foreign policy committees.
All right, fine. Well, I guess, of course, is John Curacao, and his book is called The Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror. It's fascinating reading, and of course it's got a lot of little details and tidbits in here. But of course we'll be telling you in just a moment or two the most important part of the story. A part of the story which suggests that much of what we've been told by the controlled media just is not true as to why the United States went to war. If with Iraq, we'll be right back. Well, this is Dr. Stan, and Chris John eventually wanted, actually left the Central Intelligence Agency. Unfortunately, as so often happens with the CIA, why, of course, he was away so much of the time, and his wife eventually left him, and they were divorced, and she moved home, back home, close to where he had come from, with their two sons. And so the CIA, of course, wasn't going to put him in a position where he'd be able to visit his children. And so he left the CIA so that he could actually go to visit his sons on a very regular basis. And for 10 years, why, he's almost 10 years, every weekend he spends his weekends with his sons. And it was the CIA would not have allowed that, so he had to find other source of employment. Under any circumstances, eventually his book was published. And, of course, the really important part, well, first of all, he'd gotten into some problems with the CIA because he'd spoken out against torture. And, Cindy, do you want to talk a little bit about your thoughts on waterboarding? Of course, we're told, my goodness, we've got to waterboard these people. These are evil and wicked people. They might have some information, and we might save American lives, and we might be able to get them to tell us about the explosive bomb that's going to be set off in a major city and kill all our people. So we ought to go ahead and torture all these people because we might be able to get information out of them. And you disagreed with that, and yet we're being told by our leaders that this is perfectly all right. And in fact, none of our religious leaders, I've never yet heard a major religious leader go on public television or radio and say, this is morally wrong.
Right.
But you felt it was morally wrong, didn't you?
I did. I was approached by an official in the CIA's counterterrorist center in mid-2002, and he asked me if I would be interested in being what he called certified in the use of enhanced interrogation techniques. And I said, oh boy, I don't think I like the sound of that. I said, you know what, before I give you an answer, let me think about it. So I sought the counsel of a very senior CIA officer whom I trusted deeply. And his advice was this. He said, first of all, let's call a spade a spade. They can call it enhanced interrogation techniques or anything else they want, but it's really torture. No matter what they call it, it's torture. And you know what's going to happen? He said, we're going to do it. It's going to make us feel good in the short term. In the long term, we're going to realize how wrong it was. And then it's going to leak to the press. There's going to be a congressional investigation, and somebody's going to go to jail. Do you want to be involved in that? And I said, no. So I went back down to the counterterrorist center, and I said, thank you, but this is not something I want to be involved with.
And that didn't make you very popular. And then did you even speak out against this publicly somewhere down the line?
I did. In December of 2007, I gave an interview to Brian Ross of ABC News. And frankly, I did it in a naive fashion, not realizing at the time that I was the first CIA officer ever to confirm the fact that the CIA was waterboarding prisoners. In retrospect, I'm glad that I did. Even though the intervening years have been difficult for me, it was the right thing to do. I felt that the issue needed to be explained. I felt that the American people had the right to know what its government was doing. And you have to ask yourself, if the U.S. military is not allowed to do this, and the FBI is not allowed to do this, and no other organization in government is allowed to do this, then why in the world is the CIA doing it? I think it cheapens the country, and I think it cheapens the organization. There was a very important interview about 3 weeks ago, Dr. Stan, given by the Deputy Director for Operations at the CIA by the name of Mike Sulik. He spoke at DePauw University, and in response to a question, he said that the CIA never obtained any intelligence through the use of waterboarding that it could not have obtained using more traditional interrogation techniques. So that's the first ever admission by a sitting official of the CIA that waterboarding and other torture techniques do not work.
But of course, we have been characterized by people throughout the world as bullies who torture people, and they're, in my estimation, they're absolutely right. And George Bush told the American people we would never authorize that. And he knew he'd already authorized it. And Donald Rumsfeld said we would never authorize the use of torture, and they were simply lying to the American
yes.
people. Well, let's get back to what I think is the most important part of your book. And the reason everybody should read this is because you'd returned to the United States, certainly in the early part of 2002, this was after your raid there in Pakistan, where you'd captured the number three man, the Taliban. And so what happened at that time that was so significant?
Well, I came back from Pakistan, and I was promoted and became the executive assistant to the deputy director of the CIA. And as part of that job, I had to be read into a new compartment. And what that means is a compartment is a stream of information that is so sensitive that you have to sign a special secrecy agreement before you're allowed access to it. So on my first day in that job, I went to the Office of Near East Operations, and I signed my secrecy agreement. Finally, I asked the man who was reading me in, So what gives? What's this all about? He put down his pen, he looked me in the eye, and he said, here's the deal. Next year, in March of 2003, we're going to invade Iraq, we're going to overthrow Saddam Hussein, and we're going to open the largest Air Force base in the world. And we're going to move all of our air assets out of Saudi Arabia into Iraq so that we can deprive Osama bin Laden of his argument that we're polluting the land of the two holy mosques. And I was so stunned by this revelation, all I could think of to say was, but we haven't caught bin Laden yet. And he chuckled and said, it's a done deal, it's not worth arguing over, the decision has already been made.
In other words, by the early part of 2002, the decision was already made not only that we were going to invade Iraq, but even the month we were going to invade Iraq. And all this fol-de-rol about, oh my goodness, we just found out about these weapons of mass destruction that Saddam Hussein has, and he might give to Al-Qaeda, and Al-Qaeda might then use them against us, and the yellow cake and all of this thing. This was all simply a cover. To justify an illegal invasion of Iraq, which was planned. And of course, isn't this considered a war crime to invade a country that doesn't threaten you?
I think it probably is. And there was some detail to this too. When I pressed the guy, he said, "What we're going to do is, by the end of the year, we're going to go to the United Nations. We're going to make it look like we want an international coalition." But we know that the Russians, the Chinese, and probably the French will oppose us and will be willing to go it alone. He said, we expect to enter Iraqi territory by March of 2003. I was stunned. I tell a story in the book also of one instance in which I went up to his office to drop something off, and he was sitting at his desk redesigning the Iraqi flag with some Crayola magic markers. And I said, what are you doing? He said, oh, I'm redesigning the Iraqi flag. And I said, my goodness, don't you think the Iraqis should be redesigning the Iraqi flag? As if the thought had never occurred to him that he shouldn't be the one doing it. This is the environment, the atmosphere that we were working in at that time. It was almost surreal.
And I think, ladies and gentlemen, this is really probably, to me, I read the book, and it's really all fascinating, a lot of great information in it, but the fact that it was known almost a year ahead of time, exactly what was going to happen, when we were going to invade Iraq, and all the fol-de-rol that you were hearing through the media and television and radio and news magazines and the Newsweek and U.S. News and World Report is, it was all fol-de-rol. I mean, the decision has already been made by the people who really run things behind the scenes. We were going to attack Iraq, and what was this, about at least 9 or 10 months before the attack came?
At least. And there was something even more offensive, and that was Vice President Cheney's determination to try to link Saddam Hussein with the September 11th attacks. The truth of the matter is there was absolutely no connection between Saddam Hussein and Al-Qaeda. Saddam Hussein was only barely Muslim. There's a famous story about when Saddam went to Saudi Arabia to make the Hajj. He didn't even know the prayers, and an aide had to kneel next to him and whisper the prayers to him so that he could repeat them. But there was really nothing religious about Saddam at all. In fact, Al-Qaeda hated Saddam Hussein almost as much as they hated the United States. So the idea that Saddam was connected to the 9/11 attacks was so preposterous inside the agency that many of us called it the big lie. And one thing that frightened us was that it actually seems to take hold among the American public, as though every time Dick Cheney repeated this lie, more and more people believed it. And I think we still see that in public opinion polls today, where there's still a large minority of Americans who believe that Saddam Hussein helped to coordinate the 9/11 attacks with Al-Qaeda.
And somebody once said, it doesn't matter how ridiculous something is, if you say it often enough and convincingly enough, people will eventually believe. And this is the great tragedy of today and why I do what I do. And I'm sure this is why John is willing to come on at late at night back where he lives, but he's staying up late to share this story with you. I think it's so important. As you've told this story, certainly on other radio programs, what sort of response have you gotten?
You know, it's funny, Dr. Stan. Most people just don't seem to care about Iraq anymore. To me, this information is explosive, and it's something that Americans ought to be concerned about. But I'm surprised at how few people really focus on Iraq. They want to hear fun stories. They want to hear something exciting. But they don't want to hear any notion that the government may have committed a crime.
And, of course, we've lost probably 4,000 men dead and I don't know how many tens of thousands permanently crippled in Iraq. And as some people estimate, we may have killed as many as a million Iraqi civilians. Maybe it's only 500,000, but I would think it's probably much, much higher than that. And, of course, all the depleted uranium there will contaminate that area of the world for a good long time. Depleted uranium coming from the use of UN, of course, munitions. And yet, where is the concern? And, you know, men and women do become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. Let me repeat that. Men and women become accomplices to the evils they fail to oppose. And you out there in the listening audience, what are you doing about this? Are you going to get this information, get the book, try to help us get a copy of this tape and try to help us get the information out? Our number, of course, is 1-888-24-LIBERTY. 1-888-24-LIBERTY or 464-8295. And this is really one of the most explosive stories by an insider. And I am amazed that you must have had somebody there really working in your favor to get permission to tell this story after all the secrecy agreements that you'd signed. I think it was just almost like a truly miraculous that you were able to write this story.
I was very fortunate in that George Tenet's book came out before mine did. And because of his authority as a former director, he really blazed a new trail in terms of what could be released and what couldn't. So I argued in the end successfully that, wait a minute, you let George Bush say ABC in his book, certainly you have to let me now say XYZ. And, you know, that, along with a threat of a lawsuit, I think finally made them give in.
Well, that and probably the change in administration was an important thing, wasn't it?
That was the key. That was the key. The administration changed.
And certainly sometimes with an administration change, there's a little confusion there. And I suspect that somebody in the CIA wanted your information out and said, however it came about, I'm just so grateful it did. Because I think, ladies and gentlemen, it's so vitally important that you understand that when George Bush got up and said, oh, we just found out about those weapons of mass destruction, and boy, we're just trying to protect you, and he wasn't telling the truth, and Dick Cheney wasn't telling the truth, and all the media wasn't telling the truth. And have you read about this book, The Reluctant Spy, in any of your publications? And before we go on, do you have a web page, and how can people get your book?
Oh, thank you. The book is available in most bookstores, Barnes & Noble, Borders, Books A Million, Joseph Beth, and at Amazon.com. Called The Reluctant Spy, My Secret Life in the CIA's War on Terror.
And it really is a fascinating story, and of course, an awful lot of good people in the CIA. You know, I think there may be some other things that go on. The CIA is really highly compartmentalized, isn't it, so that you wouldn't necessarily know what other people in the CIA were doing?
That's exactly right. In fact, I had an experience the night that we turned Abu Zubaydah over for movement to a secret prison. The private plane landed that was going to take him onto this prison, and one of the CIA officers, clad completely in black, got off the plane wearing a black mask and black sweater, and he came up
black,
to me
black
and said,
mask?
Yeah, black mask.
Okay,
and
go ahead.
He came up and said, John, and I said, who are you? And he lifted his mask up, and he was a former supervisor of mine. And I laughed, and I said, what are you doing here in the middle of the night? And he said, I'm here to take your prisoner. Who did you catch? And I said, I'm sorry, but unfortunately, you don't have a need to know who we caught. And I said to him, where are you taking him? And he laughed, and he said, I'm sorry, but you don't have a need to know where we're taking him. And we laughed, but, you know, I knew, and he knew that we were right. It was none of my business where they were taking him. And frankly, he didn't need to know Abu Zubaydah's identity just to take him from point A to point B. But that's very typical and normal of work in the CIA. It's highly compartmentalized.
Well, now, basically, did you go with him after that, or how did you happen to be with him then when he was recovering from his injuries?
No, once he left Pakistan in late March 2002, I never saw him again. He went on to a secret prison. From there, he was moved another couple of times, and he finally found his way to Guantanamo, where he sits today.
All right, fine. And suddenly you say you really talked to him. He loved poetry. He loved. Really was very interested in the philosophy of religion.
He was very interested in religion, not in an ideological way, but in a more historical and philosophical way. He wanted to debate the merits of Islam versus Christianity. He loved writing poetry. He liked to recite the poetry. He was quite an accomplished doodler. He had a little book that he carried with him, and he would draw pictures and poems in the book, and it was really quite impressive. He was very artistic.
Well, as a human being, did you like him?
Boy, that's a good question, and you know, you're the first person that's ever asked me that.
Well, you don't have to answer if you haven't thought of it, but really, somebody who likes to quote poetry and write poetry, you know, somebody I could identify with, even if we disagreed philosophically. We get a lot of people on my programs I don't necessarily agree with, but I can like them and get along with them.
That's right.
And because this is one of the big problems today, I mean, in an effort to get us to hate the Muslims, I'm very worried that we're moving towards a war with Iran, and there's an organized effort within this country today to get the Christian population to hate the Muslim population. I'm sure they're working over there in the Muslim countries to get them to hate us, and this isn't going to solve the problems, do you think?
I agree with you completely.
We'll be back in just a moment here to wrap up tonight's program with John Carrico. Well, John, we've got 3 minutes for you to wrap up the program, and then we'll let you get to sleep. But what are your thoughts you'd like to leave for our listeners out across America?
Well, one of the reasons why I wrote this book is I want the American people to understand how hard the CIA works.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look. And I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your 2-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com.
Whole Taliban network, or most of the Taliban network in the United States, they refused to follow through with the evidence. Why would you do that unintentionally? We hear the same story over and over again from Paul Williams in one of his books about all the information the FBI had. And this was they obtained from the fellow who actually killed Rabbi Kahana, who headed Koch here in the United States, and he was assassinated. They raided the home of the assassin, and they got all the files that would have led them to anticipate the bombing of the World Trade Center, the first bombing in 93, and the FBI refused to do anything about it. And it wasn't because they didn't know what was going on, because they were tracking all of these people. If you've never seen the DVD, so vitally important, called Jihad in America. Now, this was totally suppressed in America. It was initially released in 1994. A lot of it FBI footage of as they were tracking the Islamic terrorists in the late 1880s and the early 1990s. The DVD was shown one time on television and then banned, so it could never be shown again. It was never shown again until after the September 11th bombing. And you have to ask yourself, why would that be? This is one of the most important DVDs ever made. It's called Jihad in America. It's available from Radio Liberty. I think it's in video form, but it's well worthwhile getting, well worthwhile watching a number of times. And then, of course, to really understand what's going on, let me suggest a book we carry called The Devil's Game. Goes into how the CIA and MI6 created the whole Islamic terrorist movement, how they created the Islamic terrorist movement, how they financed and created Hamas, these wicked terrorists who were attacking Israel today, and yet they were actually financed and organized by the CIA and the Mossad, and the Mossad are the best enemy money could buy. And as with so many things that go on today, nothing is it appears to be. So the book is called The Devil's Game. We do carry Robert Baer's excellent book entitled See No Evil, where he actually goes into his experience working in Kurdistan at the same time John Carrico was there. And they apparently are good friends. But John has written, pardon me, Robert Baer has written several books. One of them, of course, going into the background of the coming war with Iran. He thinks we should not be going to war. And I say we should not be going to war, but it would appear that the Brotherhood of Darkness is intent upon plunging the world into a great and horrible and bloody war in the Middle East. All you need to do is read the newspapers, read the Wall Street Journal, read the New York Times, one supposedly on the right, the other on the left, but really both sides controlled by the same people, as they gradually condition the American people to be prepared to go to war, to protect Israel, to protect ourselves, to protect the world against the wicked Iranians who were installed back in 1979 by the very CIA that is so compartmentalized that most people working for the CIA have no idea what's going on. We hope you'll want to get the books I mentioned, certainly the Sleep in the See No Evil, the Devil's Game, the DVD entitled Jihad in America. They're all available by calling 1-800-544-8927. You need to get my book, Brotherhood of Darkness, and read it through several times. You get the DVD. Or if you can't afford it, watch it free on the Internet at RadioLiberty.com under videos. That's RadioLiberty.com, because you can listen to our programs there 9 hours a day on the satellite, 4 hours live. Get the information. Help us to get it out. We're involved in a spiritual battle that is energizing dark spiritual forces. Our number 1-800-544-8927. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and our protection. This is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and that illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion and delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I need to remind you the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They happen to be my views. And, well, hopefully they're going to be the views of William Federer this evening. I hope Bill will be available. And he's usually very, very punctual. We're going to be talking about president's speeches, and Bill has written so many wonderful books. If you've never read his book, America's God and Country, or certainly his books on George Washington Carver, or St. Nicholas, or certainly on going into what every American should know about the Quran. We carry probably about 10 of William Federer's books, just because they're always so very well organized and full of information that you need to know. Well, right now we've got William Federer on the line. Hi, Bill. How are we doing?
Oh, great, Dr. Stan.
Well, what were we going to talk about tonight?
Well, I had written a new book. It's called Prayers and Presidents. And it goes through all of the National Day of Prayers and Days of Fasting and Days of Thanksgiving that the past presidents have enacted. And it's very interesting, especially in light of the current president last year deciding not to celebrate the National Day of Prayer, though he did celebrate a International Ramadan Day and did celebrate the National Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, Transgender. But this year, the president has enacted his agenda by having the Pentagon disinvite Franklin Graham, who is the chairman of the National Day of Prayer Task Force. And so this is not only a slap in the face to all of those who care about the National Day of Prayer, it's actually enacting the dhimmi status. People forget that when Muslims take over countries, non-Muslims are forbidden from insulting Islam. And so the fact that he had Franklin Graham disinvited because he had said something that might insult Islam, that the president is, in effect, establishing the dhimmi status, making America subjected Muslim country. But the days of prayer have a long history in America, and if you'd want, I could go through that real quick.
I think we should. I think that it is very, very significant that President Obama is part of this anti-Christian element. He professes to be a Christian. I do not believe he's a Christian. In fact, you go to our website, and in the section, you know, videos around the web, just go to the one that talks about Obama's faith, Muslim faith, or actually we have a section there where he actually talks about his Muslim faith. But the average American's not going to be able to know that. I think the American people have to be well aware of the fact that there really are forces at work in our society who hate Christianity. There's a conspiracy against Christianity. That's why they took God and prayer and the Ten Commandments out of our schools. And until the American people understand that, why are they so anxious to take a cross down out in the middle of the desert? In fact, somebody went down there and recently just chopped it down after the Supreme Court said it could stay there. There is a conspiracy against God, and of course, apparently, President Obama is going right along with that. He wanted to do away with the day of prayer. What was his justification for us doing away with the day of prayer this time, Bill?
Simply because he wanted to have it be personal. I don't know. He's yet to join a church. He's not yet joined a church. And on Christmas Day, he went surfing.
I think that tells us a great deal. I hope people go to our website and look up under the section of videos on the web, the very sections that talk about President Obama's Muslim faith. We'll be back here in just a moment with William Federer as we begin talking about the importance of prayer in America. William, go right ahead.
Well, the days of prayer have a long history in America. The colonists declared days of prayer when there were droughts, Indian attacks, and threats from other nations. They had this idea that when things were bad, they would have days of prayer. When things were real bad, they would have days of fasting and prayer. And then when things turned around, they would have days of thanksgiving, which indicates that they were not deists. The idea of deism started when Sir Isaac Newton discovered the laws of gravitational force and the planetary motion, and so some of these people said, oh, there are laws? Well, maybe God made the laws and left. And so so they think, well, he made the laws of nature and left, and so these deists did not believe that God intervened, so why bother praying? So none of our founders or presidents were deists. They all believed in prayer and that God would intervene in response. So here is Edward Winslow. He was one of the pilgrims, and he wrote of the pilgrims' experiences. It's in Alexander Young's Chronicles of the Pilgrims. He stated, drought and the like considerations moved not only every good man privately to enter into examination with his own estate between God and his conscience, and so to humiliation before him, but also to humble ourselves together before the Lord by fasting and prayer. So the pilgrims did the private thing, and then together they would fast and pray. In colonial Connecticut, the settlers actually proclaimed by legal authority a day in every spring for fasting and prayer. The governor customarily selected Good Friday as the annual spring fast day. In 1668, the Virginia House of Burgesses in Jamestown passed an ordinance stating the 27th of August shall be appointed as a day of humiliation, fasting, and prayer to implore God's mercy. If any person be found upon day and that day gaming, drinking, or working, works of necessity accepted, upon presentment by church wardens and proof, he shall be fined 100 pounds of tobacco. So here in colonial Virginia in 1668, if you skipped out on the day of fasting, you'd have to pay 100 pounds of tobacco. A little different back then. Here's Yale College in 1787. There are requirements that all scholars are obliged to attend divine worship in the college chapel on Lord's Day and on days of fasting and thanksgiving appointed by public authority. Well, one interesting day of fasting there in Massachusetts was in the year 1746. The French, under Admiral d'Anville, had sailed for New England, commanding the most powerful.
Hold that thought. Hold that thought. We'll be right back here. Well, this is Dr. Stan. Cindy Wyndham is giving us the background of these ideas of days of prayer here in the United States. And certainly there was in Virginia rules that there was a day of prayer. And if you violated that day of prayer, unless, of course, you had a very, very good excuse for us, you were going to be fined 100 pounds of tobacco for, you know, violating the day of prayer. And then he was beginning to tell us about this French fleet that was sailing to America during the colonial times. And what was that story about, William?
Well, it's right before the French and Indian War. So France and England are sort of heating up in their animosities. And so the French spent 2 years building 70 ships. These were huge armada-style ships. So they had 13,000 troops, and they set sail to burn every English settlement along the eastern coast of America, starting at Louisburg, Nova Scotia, then working their way down to Boston, New York, and all the way to Georgia. This was their plans. Well, the Massachusetts governor, William Shirley, declared a day of prayer and fasting on October 16, 1746, to pray for deliverance. In the Old South Meeting House there in Boston, where the people met and also prayed, the Reverend Thomas Prince had an assembly, and he prayed, "Send thy tempest, Lord, upon the water. Scatter the ships of our tormentors." Historian Catherine Drinker Bowen related that as the pastor finished praying, the sky darkened, the winds shrieked, and church bells rang a, quote, "wild and uneven sound, though no man was in the steeple." A hurricane subsequently sank and scattered the French fleet, with 4,000 sick and 2,000 dead, including Admiral d'Anville. The French Vice Admiral d'Estournelles threw himself on his sword. And Henry Wadsworth Longfellow wrote a poem, The Ballad of the French Fleet. He writes, "Admiral d'Anville had sworn by cross and crown to ravage with fire and steel our helpless Boston town. From mouth to mouth spread tidings of dismay. I stood in the Old South saying, humbly, let us pray. Like a potter's vessel broke, the great ships of the line were carried away as smoke or sank in the brine." Well, that was 1746. If we fast forward a few years to the Boston, the French and Indian War, after the war, the British won, but they felt like they needed to keep their troops on American soil and have the Americans pay for this and put their troops in American houses, which the Americans didn't like. And so in Boston, there was a crowd protesting, and the British fired into the crowd, killing five. It's called the Boston Massacre. And then the British made all these taxes be paid by the colonists, and so that resulted in the Boston Tea Party. It was a Tea Party movement, but the king didn't like the Tea Party movement, so he cracked down on them, and he gave the orders to blockade the Boston Harbor to go into effect on June 1st, 1774. Well, in the next colony over, Virginia, their legislature, their House of Burgesses, Thomas Jefferson is there, and lo and behold, he drafts a day of fasting and prayer for Virginia to go into effect June 1st of 1774, the same day that the Boston Harbor is to be blockaded. It passes unanimously. It's supported by Patrick Henry, Richard Henry Lee, George Mason, and this is Thomas Jefferson's proclamation of fasting. It says, "This house, being deeply impressed with apprehension from the great dangers to be derived by British America from the hostile invasion of the city of Boston in our sister colony of Massachusetts, deem it highly necessary that the day aforesaid, the first day of June, be set apart by members of this house as a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer, devoutly to implore the divine interposition for averting the heavy calamity which threatens destruction of our civil rights." Goes on to say, "Ordered, therefore, that the members of this house do attend with the speaker and the mace and to the church in the city for the aforesaid purposes." So they actually met there in the street outside of the House of Burgesses with the pastor in front and the speaker of the house and their royal mace of political leadership there. And they marched down the street to Bruton Parish Church. And there, Reverend Mr. Prince read prayers, and Reverend Mr. Watkin preached a sermon. George Washington wrote in his diary, June 1st, 1774, "Went to church fasted all day. Now, Virginia's royal governor, Lord Dunmore, didn't like this day of fasting and prayer on the day the king was blockading the Boston Harbor. He viewed the resolution as a veiled protest against the king, and so he dissolved the House of Burgesses, which resulted in these legislators going down the street to Raleigh Tavern, named after Sir Walter Raleigh, who founded Virginia. And there at Raleigh Tavern, these Virginia legislators decided two things. One, they would stop importing British goods to try to hurt them economically. And second, they decided to plan a Continental Congress. So they had the first Continental Congress and then the second, and then they voted for independence. So in an interesting way, we never would have had the Declaration had it not been for the First Continental Congress, and we never would have had the First Continental Congress had not Thomas Jefferson had a resolution of fasting and prayer that caused the Virginia governor to disband their legislature. So anyway, in 1775, in April 15th, 4 days before the Battle of Lexington, the governor of Massachusetts' provincial Congress was John Hancock. And John Hancock wrote, "In circumstances dark as these, it becomes us as men and Christians to reflect that whilst every prudent measure should be taken to ward off impending judgment, that a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer should be observed to confess the sins and to implore forgiveness for all our transgressions." Now, we know John Hancock because he later became the president of the Continental Congress and was the first to sign the Declaration of Independence. That's why he put your John Hancock here. And anyway, on April 19, 1775, Governor Trumbull of Connecticut does the same thing. He has a day of fasting and prayer. He says that God would graciously pour out his Holy Spirit on us, bring us to a thorough repentance and an effectual reformation, that our iniquities may not be our ruin, that he would restore, preserve, and secure the liberties of this and all other British American colonies, and so on and so forth, and make our land a holy mountain. Well, June 12, 1775, here we have just 2 months after the Battle of Lexington and Concord, where the shot was fired around the world. John Hancock is now the president of the Continental Congress, and John Hancock has a day of fasting passed. He says this, "Congress, considering the present critical, alarming, and calamitous state, do earnestly recommend that Thursday, the 12th of July, 1775, be observed by the inhabitants of all English colonies as a day of public humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that we may, with united hearts and voices, unfeignedly confess and deplore our many sins and offer up our joint supplications to the all-wise, omnipotent, and merciful disposer of events. Beseeching him to forgive our iniquities, it is recommended to Christians of all denominations to assemble for the public worship and to abstain from servile labor and recreations on said day." Well, just a month later, July 5th of 1775, Georgia, they have a provincial Congress, and they send a message to the royal governor. So we got two sets of government going on here, the provincial, which is sort of the patriots, and then there's the royal governor. Well, this was their motion. Says the Provincial Congress gives a motion that this Congress apply to His Excellency, the Royal Governor, requesting him to appoint a day of fasting and prayer throughout this province of Georgia on account of the disputes subsisting between America and the parent state. Well, July 7th, 2 days later, 1775, Georgia's Provincial Governor, James Wright, writes, "Gentlemen, I have taken the request made by a Provincial Congress, but I must premise that I cannot consider that meeting as constitutional. But as the request is expressed in such loyal and dutiful terms, and the end proposed being such as every good man must ardently wish for, I certainly will appoint a day of fasting and prayer to be observed throughout this province of Georgia." Well, 5 days later, the Continental Congress has a day of fasting, and this is what John Adams writes to his wife, Abigail. "We have appointed a continental fast. Millions will be upon their knees at once before their great Creator, imploring His forgiveness and blessings, Smiles on American Consul and Arms. And then July 19th, 1775, the Continental Congress journals record, agreed the Congress meet here tomorrow morning at half after 9 in order to attend divine services at Mr. Duche's church. And then in the afternoon, they meet here to go from this place to attend divine service at Dr. Allison's church. And so that was 1775. And then 1776, just a few months before Congress unanimously passes the Declaration of Independence, here's George Washington's orders. He says, Thursday, the 7th of March, 1776, being set apart as a day of fasting, prayer, and humiliation, to implore the Lord and giver of all victory to pardon our manifold sins and wickedness, that it would please him to bless the Continental Army with divine favor and protection. All officers and soldiers are strictly enjoined to pay all due reverence and attention on that day to the sacred duties at the Lord of hosts for his mercies already received and for those blessings which our holiness and uprightness of life can alone encourage us to hope through his mercy to obtain. And I can go on and on. I hear the music there, but it's
go right ahead. I'll tell you when we have to quit.
Well, here we go. March 16, 1776, General William Livingston makes a resolution, and the Continental Congress passes it unanimously. It says, Congress desires to have all men of all ranks duly impressed with a sense of God's superintending providence, earnestly recommends Friday, the 17th of May, to be observed by these colonies.
Hold that thought. You know, at one time, America was a Christian nation. There was no question that people looked to God for our protection. Isn't it a shame our leaders don't believe that today? Go right ahead.
Well, and I love the end of this.
Gold and silver is tremendously undervalued. Global demand vastly exceeds mine supply by more than 60% annually. There is little in the financial world more certain than a coming explosion in the prices of gold and silver. The U.S. dollar continues to lose value and respect as the world's reserve currency. Our nation faces challenges on many fronts, and a day doesn't pass without another economist bringing forth warnings of impending economic calamity. There has never been a better time than right now to acquire physical gold and silver. Discount Gold and Silver Trading was founded on the principles of truth and honesty. We believe in providing a quality product, quality service, and most importantly, competitive pricing. We provide all forms of precious metals, including American gold, silver, platinum, and rare investment and circulated coins. Silver bars, rounds, and 90% silver bags are on hand for the silver investor. Gold self-directed IRAs are available. Call Discount Gold and Silver Trading at 1-800-375-4188. Toll free, that's 1-800-375-4188.
Well, many men begin having prostate symptoms when they get to be 60 years of age, so Radio Liberty is offering a great product. It's called Prostate Support. It's put together by one of the country's leading health food manufacturers. It contains ingredients which have been proven to work. I know health experts who take the product, and I use it as well, and I think that really is very effective. In addition, we have a product for women during that difficult time of life. It's called Menopause Support. And lastly, we have a product for people who have chronic difficulty with their immune system and nothing else seems to work. It's called Immune Support. All are available by calling 1-800-544-8927. 1-800-544-8927. These products are compiled by a very reliable company. Give us a call, 1-800-544-8927.
Did you know that there's an increasing amount of scientific data which says that fluoride in drinking water is dangerous? Are you aware that your drinking water may in fact contain many unhealthy substances, even things which can cause sickness or disease? If you'd like information on how to remove these contaminants, find out about the Verky water filter. You can call 800-544-8927 for complete information. There is a way to return to having pure, safe drinking water. The Verky water filter. Call 800-544-8927 for information about a product that could protect you and your family from waterborne disease. The number to call is 800-544-8927. call today.
This is Pastor David Whitney with Institute on the Constitution. Our founders constructed this constitutional republic with the intent that citizens would function as the final check on the power of civil government. But that design would only work if the citizens understood our form of government as well as their responsibilities within that structure. That's why Institute on the Constitution has put together a host kit that enables anyone, anywhere, with any group of people to instruct them on our founding documents. We urge you to order a host kit. You can call us toll-free at 866-730-9796. That's 866-730-9796. Or you can order on the web. Go to our website, iotconline.com. The only way our republic will survive is if its citizens arm themselves with the knowledge of our founding fathers' original intent of the Constitution, the Declaration, and the Bill of Rights. Call us, 866-730-9796.
It's the day when President Obama wants to do away with the day of prayer, an intense hatred of certainly everything America stands for and our religious foundations. And you have to ask yourself, why does the President of the United States reject Christianity, you know, and a day of prayer? And will God continue to bless this nation if we do not honor him? And those words of Thomas Jefferson, we've said them before, but, you know, as he said, God who gave us life, gave us liberty, but can the liberty of a nation be secure when the conviction has been forgotten that liberty is the gift of God? I tremble for my country when I reflect that God is just, and his justice will not sleep forever. Ladies and gentlemen, I think we're beginning to see God's justice coming upon this country. Go right ahead.
Well, you're bringing out a very interesting point. President Obama did admit that for 10 years he went to school in Indonesia as a Muslim, and he studied Muslim prayers and prayed five times a day and prayed in Arabic. And the Muslim prayers is called the Shahalah, and they make the Muslim statement of faith that there's one God, his name is Allah, and Muhammad is his prophet. And so they would say this multiple times every day for 10 years. And so this is his upbringing. And we see that, you know, train up a child in the way he shall go type of thing. It's very different from America's founding. And the fact that today 78% of Americans identify themselves as Christian. I repeat, 78%. That's what the Pew Religious Landscape Survey had. And that's about 52% Protestant, 25% Catholic, 2% Eastern Orthodox or other Christian, 2% Jewish, 2% Mormon, 0.5% Hindu, 0.5% Buddhist, and 0.6% Muslim, and then 1.6% atheist. And so we see that, you know, when you have 1.6% atheists and a 0.6% Muslim, that when they decide that they want their will passed, that the 78% Christians get relegated to the back of the bus. And so this is quite a change from the founding of our country. Going back into the, I wrote a book. The title of the new book is called Prayers and Presidents. I'm real excited about it. And this goes through every one of the presidents and their proclamations of prayer. Matter of fact, when finishing up the beginnings of our country, Ben Franklin at the Constitutional Convention, 1787, wrote, "In the beginning of the contest with Great Britain, when we were sensible of danger, we had daily prayer in this room for divine protection." So he admits daily prayer. And then Ronald Reagan, 1983, said, "In 1775, the Continental Congress proclaimed the first National Day of Prayer. In 1783, the Treaty of Paris officially ended the long, weary Revolutionary War, during which a National Day of Prayer had been proclaimed every spring for 8 years. And then we go to James Madison. Here he is in the Virginia legislature in 1785. James Madison introduces a bill for appointing days of public fasting and thanksgiving, which included forfeiting 50 pounds for every failure not to have a reasonable excuse. So here's this. James Madison is the one who introduced the First Amendment, and here he is in Virginia putting forth a bill for days of fasting with a fine if you didn't. Now, this isn't interesting. aspect is the same week Congress passed the First Amendment and the Bill of Rights. The very same week, Congress asks George Washington, as president, to declare a day of thanksgiving to God for the First Amendment. And so here's Washington's proclamation. It is the duty of all nations to acknowledge the providence of Almighty God, to obey His will, and to humbly implore His protection and favor. And whereas both houses of Congress have by a joint committee requested me to recommend to the people of the United States a day of public thanksgiving and prayer to be observed by acknowledging with grateful hearts the many signal favors of Almighty God, especially by affording them an opportunity peaceably to establish a form of government for their safety and happiness, I do recommend the 26th of November be devoted by the people of the United States to the service of that great and glorious being who is the author of all the good that ever was, that is, or that will be, that we may with united rendering to him our sincere thanks. And I love this part. And the thanks for the peaceful and rational manner in which we have been enabled to establish constitutions of government. And so here is Washington thanking God for the Constitution. How could the Constitution have outlawed God? The same week they passed the First Amendment, he has a proclamation of thanksgiving for the First Amendment. And so, obviously, the First Amendment was not intended to outlaw God.
And of course, it didn't. It had nothing to do with outlawing God. Well, this is Dr. Stan. I guess this is William Fetter, and we're talking about the background of the history of prayer in the United States, using certainly the fact that President Obama, the President of the United States, has suddenly wanted to do away with the day of prayer. He doesn't think it's important for whatever reason. He wanted to do away with it. Fortunately, Shirley Dobson let him know under no question at all that we were going to have a day of prayer, whether he liked it or not. Maybe it's about time we had more of our politicians who have the courage of Shirley Dobson. Anyway, good for her. Go right ahead, William.
Well, we just can't overlook the fact that here, the very week they passed the First Amendment, Congress passes unanimously a day of fasting and prayer, or thanksgiving and prayer. But let's look a little bit further. We have the Whiskey Rebellion in western Pennsylvania. They didn't want to have to pay the taxes, and it causes an uprising. Washington gets on horseback and leads the army to western Pennsylvania, and the rebels are dispersed. And Washington, instead of doing what English monarchs would do, gather the traitors and behead them, he just simply forgave them and went back to Washington. And that set a great precedent in American politics, that you don't try to kill and destroy your people that are expressing their political differences. But so Washington, George Washington, again has a proclamation in 1794. He says, in perfect reliance on the gracious providence, the people of the United States have been permitted under divine favor and perfect freedom to elect their own government. Well, then we have John Adams as president. George Washington is retired at Mount Vernon. The year is 1799, the same year that Washington dies. John Adams asks George Washington if he would consider being the commander of the Continental Army again. I mean, here he is, right before he's going to die, says, hey, would you put the uniform on again? Washington writes back and says, since every other, you know,
hold that thought. I'll be back in just a moment here. Yeah, this is Dr. Stan. Our guest, of course, is William Fetter, and we talk about his latest book. William, before we go on, I want you to get your web page out there, your telephone number, and tell people the name of the book and how they can get it, although I think we'll probably carry it. I want them to be able to get this as soon as possible. I think it's very important. At this time, if there was ever a time when, of course, we need prayer, it's now. In fact, if you would have a bit of time to send me a copy of it, I'd love to see it, and probably will carry it for you. But how can people get the book from you?
Well, AmericanMinute.com is my website, AmericanMinute.com, and the title of the book is Prayers and Presidents, Inspiring Faith from Leaders of the Past. And so I went through all the past presidents, and it's quite eye-opening stuff that is not there, but I read through all of the messages and papers of the presidents, all the public papers. It took years to read through them all, and I was amazed to see all these references to God. With the backdrop of Barbara Crabb, a federal judge, deciding that the National Day of Prayer is unconstitutional. So we see the importance of picking the right judges. We have a new person that President Obama has put forth to be a U.S. Supreme Court justice. She has no experience on the court whatsoever, no experience as a judge. CBS News got in trouble for posting on the Internet that she's a lesbian, and the White House said that they were upset that she was outed.
Everybody knows she's a lesbian. Why should we? But the thing is that she has a worldview that's entirely different than the majority of the American people, and it's a tragedy that President Obama would put a lesbian onto the Supreme Court. I think that tells us a great deal about President Obama, because actually I've talked to people who lived with him in Chicago, and, well, I will not repeat what they told me, but as far as his sexual proclivities, but it was not very favorable. These were people who knew him personally when he was in Chicago. So maybe that explains why he saw nothing wrong with putting a lesbian on our Supreme Court. Do you think God is going to continue to bless this country if the good people of this country and the religious leaders of the country don't speak out? Bill, you go right ahead.
Well, we had a crisis in 1799. John Adams asked Washington to be the commander. He does. And then John Adams declares a day of fasting and prayer. And he writes this. He goes, "As the people of the United States are still held in jeopardy by insidious acts of a foreign nation, as well as the dissemination among them of those principles subversive to the foundations of all religious, moral, and social obligations, I hereby recommend a day of solemn humiliation, fasting, and prayer, that the citizens call to mind our numerous offenses against the Most High God, confess them before him with sincerest penitence, implore his pardoning mercy through the great mediator and redeemer for past transgressions, and that through the grace of his Holy Spirit we may be disposed and enabled to yield a more suitable obedience to his righteous requisitions. Righteousness exalteth a nation, but sin is a reproach to any people." Now, I will point out that that is a Trinitarian proclamation. He mentions the Most High God, the great mediator and redeemer, and the Holy Spirit. So there's the Father, Son, and the Holy Ghost.
Well, now, basically, did George Washington put on the uniform again there in 1799?
He did. In his letter, he writes back, he says, "If at all possible, I would like to command from Mount Vernon." And France was so intimidated that George Washington, again, he is world-renowned for having stood up and defeated the King of England. England was the largest empire in the history of the world. 13 million square miles, over 532 million people under the rule of the King of England, and it was the largest empire that had ever existed and probably will ever exist until the Antichrist comes along. But when Washington stood up and beat him, you know, with kicked him out of America, so the whole world was in awe of George Washington, and so when he agreed to command the troops, France backed down. And that was where the French were impressing our soldiers and sailors and putting them on French ships, and they said that they'd stop if we paid them tribute, and the cry went across America, millions for defense, but not a cent for tribute. We didn't want to pay extortion fees. anyway, but that was in March of 1799, and Washington dies in December of 1799. But anyway, then we go to James Madison, who's now the fourth president. The War of 1812 starts, and he declares a day of prayer. He says, I do recommend rendering the sovereign of the universe public homage, acknowledging the transgressions which might justly provoke his divine pleasure, seeking his merciful forgiveness with a reverence for the unerring precept of our holy religion, to do to others as they would require that others should do to them. So what is that? That's Jesus. That's the Sermon on the Mount. And so he calls it the precept, the unerring precept of our holy religion. And so he's saying that basically Christianity is our holy religion. Anyway, the war continues, so James Madison, on July 23rd, 1813, issues another day of prayer. The war continues to go on, and the British invade. They burn the White House, the Capitol, the Library of Congress on August 25th, 1814. And Dolly Madison takes the picture of George off the mantelpiece and runs out, and there's just mass confusion. And as the British are torching the place, suddenly the sky grows dark. Clouds roll in. Tornadoes touch down, sending debris flying, blowing off roofs, knocking down chimneys on the British soldiers. Two cannons are lifted off the ground and dropped yards away. Lightning flashes, and one British historian writes, more British soldiers were killed by this stroke of nature than by all the firearms the Americans could muster in the feeble defense of their capital. And then the rains came and extinguished the fires. After this miraculous deliverance, James Madison responds by proclaiming a day of fasting and prayer, November 16, 1814. And James Madison, it's significant because he is the one who introduced the First Amendment in the first session of Congress. So if anybody were to have a clue what the First Amendment was supposed to do, it would be James Madison. And when it's his turn to be president, he acknowledges God with two proclamations and then a day of fasting. And this is what the day of fasting proclamation said. He says, in the time of present public calamity and war, a day may be observed by the people of the United States as a day of public humiliation and fasting and of prayer to God Almighty for the safety and welfare of these states, of confessing their sins and transgressions and strengthening the vows of repentance, that he would be graciously pleased to pardon all their offenses. And Dr. Stan, I just can't help but see the recurring theme of repentance and confessing of our sins. And gee, it would be difficult today for the president to even identify a sin. If he's holding events in the White House for lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgendered, I mean, he's pushing everything that would, by the traditional values, be considered sins. Where are we? Well,
I think we're in real trouble, William. I think we're in real trouble as a nation, and I think we should not be surprised to find calamity descending upon this country.
Well, my prayer is that we repent. This is just a little personal side note. Deuteronomy 28 in the Bible, the Old Testament, says, these are the blessings if my people shall hearken to the voice of the Lord. They will be the head, not the tail, and so forth. They will lend to many nations and not borrow. But these are the curses if the people do not hearken to the voice of the Lord. They will be a debtor, and the stranger amongst them will rise up and be their ruler.
Where is that in the Bible, Bill?
Deuteronomy chapter 28.
Deuteronomy chapter 28. Thank you. I'll check it out.
It's the chapter that has the blessings and the curses of hearkening to the voice of the Lord. But the debtor, the creditor debtor, in the last 30 years, America has gone from the largest creditor nation to the largest debtor nation. We've gone from lending to borrowing. In other words, if any nation ever was on the judgment side of the page, we're it. We are, says, these are the curses. If you do not hearken to the voice of the Lord, you will be a debtor, and the stranger amongst you will rise up and be your ruler. And so we are now a debtor nation. My prayer is for a Josiah generation. the ending years of Judah. You know, the 12 tribes of Israel, the 10 northern tribes were taken captive by the Assyrians in the 700 BCs and carried off to Nineveh and so forth. And the two southern tribes was Judah and Ephraim, and they kept getting more and more and more wicked. And Manasseh was the king, and Manasseh sacrificed his kids, his children, to Moloch, this iron idol statue that they'd heat up the hands and put the baby on there and let the thing scream to death, and the louder it screamed, the more pleasing it was to Moloch. I mean, it was their version of abortion. And this guy, Manasseh, he put an idol in the Holy of Holies. He used the holy altar, which was intended for sacrifices to the Lord. He used it for divination, where they'd cut open an animal and look at its gizzards and try to tell the future and everything. And God said, that's it. This is so wicked. I will destroy Judah. So a prophet comes along and says, okay, God said this is enough. You're out of here. Well, Manasseh dies. He has a son that rules wickedly for 2 years. He dies. And then there's this 8-year-old grandson of Manasseh named Josiah. And Josiah becomes king at 8. When he's 16, he starts seeking the Lord. When he's 20 years old, he tells him to clean out the temple, which had been neglected. And lo and behold, a few years later, they come out of the temple with these old, dusty scrolls. And they read it to the king. It's the law of God. And he rips his garments, and he repents. And he sends to a prophetess in town named Huldah, H-U-L-D-A, Huldah. And Huldah says, tell the man that sent you that, yes, judgment will come on this nation because of its wickedness and sins, but not during his lifetime, because he repented when he heard the words of the Lord. And so Josiah tore down the Sodomite temples. He had this huge Passover feast. It was like one of the biggest ones ever. And then Josiah scribes teaching the law of God, and for the rest of the 31-year reign of Josiah, there was peace and prosperity in Judah. Now, after he dies, it goes down the drain real fast, and Nebuchadnezzar comes and takes him captive to Babylon. But I'm praying for a Josiah generation. I'm praying that we deserve, I mean, with all the abortions and starving Terry Schiavo to death and embryonic stem cell and pushing every other alternative kind of marriage other than what God instituted in Genesis, we see that we deserve God's judgment, but I'm praying for a Josiah generation. And yet, as a nation, we have a tradition of leaders in politics calling out to God. Here's an 1832 in New York. Was gripped with an outbreak of the Asiatic cholera. And Henry Clay was a member of Congress. He asks for a joint resolution of Congress to appoint a day of public humiliation, prayer, and fasting to be observed by the people of the United States with religious solemnity. 1841, the ninth president, William Henry Harrison, dies suddenly, and the vice president, John Tyler, takes over. His first act is, you guessed it, a day of prayer and fasting. And John Tyler says, when a Christian people feel themselves to be overtaken by a great public calamity, it becomes them to humble themselves under the dispensations of divine providence. Then in 1849, the 12th president, Zachary Taylor, proclaims a day of fasting during a cholera epidemic. He writes, the providence of God has manifested itself in the visitation of a fearful pestilence which is spreading itself throughout the land. It is fitting that a people whose reliance has ever been in his protection should humble themselves before his throne, acknowledging past transgressions, ask a continuance of his divine mercy. It is earnestly recommended that Friday, the first Friday in August, be observed throughout the United States as a day of fasting, humiliation, and prayer. Then we fast forward again to James Buchanan, the 15th president, right before the Civil War. And it's beginning to heat up, and so James Buchanan has a day of fasting. He says, in this hour of calamity and peril, to whom shall we resort for relief but to the God of our fathers? His omnipotent arm only can save us from the awful effects of our crimes and follies. Let us unite in humbling ourselves before the Most High God, confessing our individual and national sins. Let me invoke every individual, in whatever sphere of life he may be placed, to feel a personal responsibility to God and his country for keeping this day holy. That was President James Buchanan, December 14, 1860. Then Lincoln's the president, and the Union loses the Battle of Bull Run. And Abraham Lincoln, August 12, 1861, declares a day of fasting. Lincoln says, "It is fit to acknowledge and revere the supreme government of God, to bow in humble submission to his chastisement, to confess and deplore their sins and transgressions in full conviction that the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Therefore, I, Abraham Lincoln, do appoint the last Thursday in September next as a day of humiliation, prayer, and fasting for all the people of the nation." Well, the war drags on. March 30th, 1863, Lincoln issues another day of fasting and prayer. Lincoln said, "The awful calamity of civil war may be but a punishment inflicted upon us for our presumptuous sins to the needful end of our national reformation as a whole people. We have forgotten God. We have vainly imagined in the deceitfulness of our hearts that all these blessings were produced by some superior wisdom and virtue of our own. Intoxicated with unbroken success, we have become too proud to pray to the God that made us. It behooves us then to humble ourselves before the offended power and to confess our national sin." That was Abraham Lincoln. He was shot, and President Andrew Johnson became the 17th president. And Andrew Johnson, April 29th, 1865, sets a day of fasting. He says this, "The 25th day of next month was recommended as a special day of humiliation and prayer in consequence of the assassination of Abraham Lincoln. But whereas my attention has since been called to the fact that the day aforesaid is sacred to large numbers of Christians as one of rejoicing for the ascension of the Savior, now I, Andrew Johnson, President of the United States, do suggest that the religious services recommended as aforesaid should be postponed till the first day of June." Here he is acknowledging the Christians in the day of ascension, the ascension of the Savior. And that was Andrew Johnson, the 17th president. And then we can fast forward to World War I. Woodrow Wilson is the president. And on May 11th, 1918, during World War I, he has a day of fasting. He says, "It being the duty peculiarly incumbent in a time of war, humbly and devoutly to acknowledge our dependence on Almighty God and implore his aid and protection, I, Woodrow Wilson, proclaim a day of public humiliation, prayer, and fasting, and exhort my fellow citizens of all faiths and creeds to assemble in that day."
Hold that thought. We'll be right back. Go right ahead.
"And to pray Almighty God that he may forgive our sins." And again.
Heart disease is on the rise. Clogged arteries, high blood pressure, and high cholesterol levels may not be fully detected by you, but the symptoms are there. Loss of energy, blood sugar spikes and drops, poor circulation, and irregular heartbeat are just a few of these that can alert you that something is wrong. Hear how Heart and Body Extract is making a difference in thousands of people's lives across America.
My blood pressure has normalized. My diabetes has totally improved.
Everyone is telling me now how much healthier I look, and I'm telling everyone how much healthier I feel. I recommend Heart and Body Extract to everyone.
Anybody over 40 in the North American continent should be using this product as a preventative to keep their cardiovascular system healthy.
Order your two-month supply today by calling 866-295-5305. That's 866-295-5305. Or order online, hbextract.com. Heart and Body Extract, 866-295-5305 or hbextract.com.
You may be new to freeze-dried foods. You may have storable food questions. You may want to buy your freeze-dried foods from a very reputable company and not go broke in the process. Welcome to the Freeze-Dry Guy. Okay, actually, we're more than just one guy. We're a California-based company that's been serving our U.S. military and other government agencies with the finest in freeze-dried storable foods and emergency rations since 1970. See all about us at freezedryguy.com. With Freeze-Dry Guy freeze-dried foods, you can and will be ready for just about any any unexpected crisis. Freeze-dried Guy foods are delicious, require little preparation, and will taste just as fresh decades from now as they do today. Just add hot water and serve. Backpackers consistently rate us number one year after year as the best tasting and ease of preparation. Isn't that what you want for your family? Visit freezedryguy.com or call 866-404-FOOD. That's 866-404-3663 or go to freezedryguy.com. Freeze Dry Guy, the best you can buy.
Where are my car keys? What did I come in this room for? Where did I put that?
A common condition called age-related memory loss is robbing millions of people of their ability to remember and think clearly. And Alzheimer's and Parkinson's are occurring at younger ages, even early 20s and 30s. And there's much evidence that brain inflammation may be the cause. Brain inflammation may also cause depression and insomnia. But there's great news. Studies show by taking special, powerful nutrients, brain inflammation and its damaging effects may be greatly reduced. And that's why neurosurgeon Dr. Russell Blaylock created his brain repair formula to reduce brain inflammation and maintain a healthy brain. So, for a free book on brain health or information on Dr. Blaylock's special brain repair formula, call 1-800-SPECIAL or visit 1-800-SPECIAL.com. 1-800-SPECIAL.
You're tuned to the Global Star Radio Network. Thanks for listening.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Power Hour Radio Show. We made it to Friday, didn't we? Yep, buddy. It is 16 July 2010. July 16, 2010, and you are in the right place. Thank you so much for joining us at the Power Hour Radio Show. 3 hours of news in which we try to make sense of an absolutely unreasonable media and federal government that wants you to be confused. That's it. That's what they want. They want you confused, and they want you thinking in ways that they choose. You know, one time I watched Mr. Eagleburger. Many of you will recall him from previous administrations. He used to work in the agenda department. Yeah, getting you to think what they want you to think. And I heard him on an interview years after he left the position saying, yeah, our goal is to get people to think of three things whenever they think of an issue. And we want to place those three things in their minds. One of them was the run-up to the Gulf War, he said. We wanted them to know that Saddam was a bad guy, that they had weapons of mass destruction, and a third one, which I can't remember right now. And he said, we went to Kansas and went in a little coffee shop there, and we asked people there, why are we going to go to war with Iraq? And they said, well, Saddam's a bad guy, weapons of mass destruction, and the third one. And he said, you know what? We done our job. So just remember that whenever you listen to the news and they tell you at the end of the segment, well, doesn't that mean that is usually what they want you to walk away with. Unfortunately, at the Power Hour, we don't give them that much credit because we know they're trying to snooze the people. But we don't do that at the Power Hour. And we're going to be talking about, yeah, the oil cap. Is it working? Is it not? Why are so many people saying don't be fooled by this? In the second hour, we're going to be talking to Captain Kelly Sweeney. He has probably been a captain of most every kind of ship, and he's going to come on board with us today at the Power Hour to help us understand what is going on with this. Is it really over? Is it really contained? If you're watching television, well, I'll tell you what's on the menu on television. It is racism, racism, racism. That's right. I am just amazed at how obvious it is. Now, Bubba on the couch can see this one clear as day. It is now the NAACP versus the Tea Party. The burqa story. Should women be allowed to wear burqas in various countries? Is it their right? Is it a religious issue? All these questions are being asked now as to whether or not women should be allowed to wear burqas. I think in the UK, France, those countries are dealing with it. I think it's coming to the United States. And you know what I think? I think it's Muslims today Christians tomorrow. So get ready. Do we think women should be allowed to perform their religious duties or their religious manner in which they believe will take them to heaven? Well, if that's what they believe, I kind of think they should be allowed to do that. If they want to go around in a black cover-up in hot weather, that's their choice. I really believe that. But of course, we've got to think about terrorism. Apple 4. I have to talk about this because this is so stupid. Does anybody not get the real issue? We'll talk about that. Along with, have you seen the commercial for Hyundai? Hyundai? If you are thinking about buying a car, put Hyundai the very bottom of your list. I will tell you why. I am absolutely, personally affronted by this commercial, and I hope you are also. We're going to be talking to Jim Motika at the bottom of the hour. He is a listener to the Power Hour. He's been a guest on the Power Hour. He's one of those educated Power Hour listeners, and we're going to talk to him about what he sees in the financial markets. He covers them and submits a lot of the financial news for the Power Hour, and we're going to let him talk to you about what's going on. Stay tuned. We'll be right back after this 3-minute break. This is Joyce Riley. Stay tuned. We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiatics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
It's the number one reason for slow and clogged bath drains. That's right, hair. And the number one way to open drains plugged with hair? The drain clog. Stop standing in dirty bath water. Stop using dangerous chemicals. Just push the drain claw past the pop-up in your sink or tub, twist, and pull. You'll be shocked at what this little tool can pull out of your drain. The drain claw has over 100 tiny hooks that claw through hair, toothpaste, and shampoo that slows and clogs your drains. See how it works right now at thedrainclaw.com. The drain claw is made in the USA and is the safest, easiest, most environmentally friendly solution to unclog bath drains. Get one for $6.99 or three for $15. The drain claw can be used over and over. Don't be fooled by substitutes. Buy the original. Buy the drain claw. Order now at thedrainclaw.com. That's the drain claw at thedrainclaw.com.
Protect your freedoms and be independent by learning how to maintain, repair, and customize your own firearms through these exclusive video training courses on DVD from the American Gunsmithing Institute. Call and get a free 2-hour sampler DVD video and catalog. See just how quickly and easily you can learn firearm disassembly and reassembly, accurizing, customizing, super tuning, refinishing, trigger repair, and much, much more for rifles, pistols, and shotguns. Courses available for both the hobbyist and the professional. You can even get certified as a gunsmith to make money part-time, full-time, or as a retirement income doing what you love. Call 1-800-247-5032 to order your free sampler DVD and catalog. That's 1-800-247-5032.